Hi, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author. I'm Jim Juno, and this is the podcast where we talk with writers who write about movies, television, Hollywood, and anything that really kind of strikes our fancy. And I have with me tonight a very special guest. His name is Gregory William Mank. That's Mank. And he has a new book out. It's published by Bear Manor Media, and it's called The Platinum Widow: Who Killed Jean Harlow's Husband? Welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's very good to be here.
Thank you for being here. Now this is a work of fiction,
It is.
but it is based on real events.
Very, very much so. It was very exhaustively researched and went very, delved very deeply into everything. The timeline of everything that happens in the story is precisely the way it happened in real life. There have been so many stories and so many accounts and so many interpretations of what exactly happened in that unfortunate event, and whether in fact Paul Byrne was killed, murdered, or whether he committed suicide, that at this point I thought, well, we probably should give up on the idea that somebody's going to come forward after 90 years and say, I know the answer. I've been sitting on this all this time, and I thought I'm going to write this up as a novel. And as it turned out, I'd actually written my first novel along these lines last year. That was called Frankenstein's Witch, and it was about a PI named Porter Down, who was involved with the production of Frankenstein in 1931 and got involved with a real life witch who had infiltrated the company at Universal. And that was a lot of fun to do. I got a big kick out of it, and it was fun. Again, great fun to research as to what actually happened in Hollywood at that time, all the different things, all the background, so on and so forth, and then put it together with fictional characters and have them interact with real life characters. So it particularly fell together with this Jean Harlow book. Of course, the characters in real life are so wonderfully vivid and had such incredible identities that it was easy to dramatize them, and then easy to have them interacting with Porter Dam and with the various other characters in the story.
And to give everybody a bit of a backstory here, when we talk about the real events, Jean Harlow, during the 1920s and 30s, she was, I would say, probably she was the first blonde bombshell of the movies. There was
She
nobody
was.
bigger.
No, she was sensational, is the word that comes to mind. She was very beautiful. The platinum hair was remarkable. Of course, it wasn't actually platinum. It was ammonia and Lux flakes and a special formula that she used every Sunday to put that together, a peroxide. Nevertheless, it looked fantastic and photographed beautifully, and she had a marvelous sexuality. And one of the things about Harlow that was really fascinating was not only was she beautiful, but she came so far in her profession so quickly. If you see her in the film that really made her a star, which is Hell's Angels, she's lovely to look at, but really not a very good actress. I mean, she's still really just kind of learning the ropes. And within a couple of years at MGM, doing films like Red-Headed Woman and Dinner at Eight, she's a terrific comedienne.
Oh,
And she
she's
could do
wonderful,
anything.
and she's
Yeah.
wonderful in Dinner at Eight. I mean,
Dinner at
if
Eight is
you're
incredible. I mean, Dinner at Eight has all those fantastic actors in it. It has, the Barrymore brothers, and it has Marie Dressler and Wallace Beery, and on and on and on. And Harlow really gives a terrific show. And at the time that the film was released in 1933, nobody could believe it. They thought, how did this girl learn all this in such a little bit of time? So it was wonderful to watch her, both because of the fact that she was so beautiful to see, and also because of the fact that that she every film she did, she emerged to be more and more of a remarkable talent. She had a very unfortunate private life, a very short one. She died in 1937. She was only 26 years old. Died of kidney failure. And so she had a very, very short time to make her mark, but she really did in the time that she was here. And she did so in spite of personal happenings that might have destroyed her career, including this one that the novel covers. She came close to being indicted for murder herself during that that particular event. And it was a terrible tragedy and very, very horrible circumstances. And she was only 21 years old at the time of that scandal, and could have knocked her flat, but she somehow managed to get back on her feet and keep going.
And we're not going to be giving anything away in the book, because what the tragedy you're referring to, she married a man named Paul Byrne, who was 42. She was 21. He was a movie executive. And he, 65 days after they were married, he was found dead, naked in the bathroom, a gunshot wound to the head, gun in his hand, and a cryptic suicide note given that was there.
Yes.
And in those days, everybody out there, you have to remember, in those days, the maid found him. Her first call wasn't to the police. It was to the studio.
That's right.
Who sent that's over. Right. Yeah. And that was the mode of operation during that time.
Absolutely. It was almost a sacred duty that if you got in trouble there, that the studio handled it. And that was one of the real problems that happened in this, was the fact that the studio had had hours head start of the police in arranging and rearranging the evidence before any real coverage by the police happened at the house. And it was very much played up. The suicide note talked about the fact that Byrne was suffering from, quote, abject humiliation, unquote. It was reported that I believe it was actually true that he was found, as you mentioned, naked, and he was drenched in Jean Harlow's perfume that apparently he had poured all over himself before firing the gun into his temple. This sort of thing. But of course, there's always been the suspicion that this was all engineered by the MGM crew, because they wanted to sort of create a story. And the story that they wanted to create was the fact that, you know, that she was such a siren, that she was such a seductress, that, you know, he was just completely overly awed by her and intimidated, and that he killed himself. Now, of course, whether or not that actually happened in real life, and of course, whether or not that happens in the book, we can't go into here. But it's interesting with Paul Byrne, because he was a brilliant man. He's been kind of badly treated by history as being like this little neurotic character who really was no match for anybody. He was very talented. He produced all of Garbo's pictures at MGM personally. He was brilliant at what he did, but he did have this rather strange side to his nature. At one point, he wanted to marry a silent screen actress named Barbara Lamar. She rejected his proposal. And his response in that case was, he also allegedly tried suicide, and he tried to drown himself in a toilet bowl. And that's how he was found. He was found with his head stuck in the seat. He never did actually get his face into the water, but he was found with his head wedged in the seat of the toilet bowl. And of course, that story in Hollywood naturally, spread all over the place. He never quite lived that one down. This was sort of this epic insecurity about the man, and this sort of there were all kinds of strange rumors, including the fact that he was actually a hermaphrodite. I mean, the poor man had all this to live with all the time, and then all of a sudden, lo and behold, he marries Jean Harlow, and so Hollywood was sort of like waiting, day to day, night to night. When is this all going to explode? When is this all going to go bad? And as you mentioned, they only had to wait 65 days for it to happen. And then, of course, everybody sat back and said, okay, what exactly did happen? Was it suicide? Was it murder? If it was murder, who was responsible? Because there were a number of very vivid and guilty-looking suspects who might have been behind an actual murder.
including Burns' ex-wife.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought her up because she was one of the characters in the book I enjoyed most delineating. She was again a very tragic soul. She was a woman who had suffered from severe mental illness. She spent a good amount of her adult life in an asylum. She had recently moved to San Francisco. Byrne was taking care of her she was living in a hotel there, and he was footing the bill. But he was keeping her, obviously, a big secret. And apparently, for a time at least, he kept her a secret from Harlow. Later, it came out they claimed that Harlow knew all about her. And it's very likely Harlow did, because Harlow was an extremely passive person. Despite how she appeared on the screen with all that directness and all that brazen quality and everything, she was very, very passive. And she was very, very devoted to making other people happy and comfortable, much more than making herself happy and comfortable. She was really kind of a heartbreaking figure in that way. But at any rate, not only did he have, was it, he had this situation with the wife, with the common law wife, Dorothy Millett, but Dorothy Millett suddenly disappeared 2 days later.
Right.
She was found drowned in the Sacramento River. The verdict for that came in suicide. So you know, there was one thing after another here that was piling up during this scandal, and the fictional hero of the story, the detective Porter Down, really has his hands full, running from one crisis to the next. You know, as far as trying to figure out what is really happening here and who is really responsible. Of course, as it is, he is actually in the house and in the room when the action takes place. And as far as Burns' actual death goes, he does know what happened. But some of the other things that happen in the book, he has to piece together, you know, in a jigsaw puzzle fashion. So, yeah.
I love in the first chapter, in the very, very, maybe it's in the, even in the, even in the introduction, Porter Down gets to slap Louis B. Mayer, which,
yes.
which I've always wanted to do if I had the chance.
Many people did. Yeah.
Down and yeah.
Yeah. He lets him have it. Yeah. Porter takes no prisoners. He's a very, very spunky guy. As I said, I think I mentioned earlier, he's a former pilot from World War I. And so he's been through a lot already in his life. He's had a lot of tragedy on his own. So by the time he gets to Golden Age Hollywood, you know, nothing awes him anymore, including Louis B. Mayer.
He lives out in the desert by himself, too.
That's right. Lives out 29 Palms. Yeah. So he's quite a character, and he's gone through a lot in these past two books, with all kinds of adventures with some colorful folk.
Now, where are you calling from tonight? Because that's you're not on the West Coast. You're on the East Coast with me.
No, I'm in right? I'm in Pennsylvania.
Right. Okay.
The Maryland Pennsylvania border.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And so I'm down here in Richmond, Virginia. So we're both East Coaster.
Yes.
East Coast people.
Yes.
Was it hard, or did you have a chance to go out to Hollywood and actually see some of these places that you write about in the book firsthand?
Yes, I did, and I'm glad you asked that question, because that was one of the really interesting things to help with this book was seeing the locales, a number of which still existed, including the house where Paul Byrne died. And it was really fascinating. I drove up there one morning, a beautiful day. It was located up in Benedict Canyon, which is above Beverly Hills, and up in the hills. And it's this very strange looking, actually, sort of fairy tale looking house, like a sort of Bavarian hunting lodge kind of look to it. You can't see it very well at all from the road. You kind of have to do a little bit of, you know, exploring to try to get a good look at the house. And I, of course, I didn't get inside. It's privately owned. I'm sure they get plenty of people, you know, knocking at the gate saying, "Hey, can I come in and see the famous Paul Byrne, you know, death house from all these years ago?" So they don't want to have to deal with another one. But it's interesting, Jim. It was so obscure. It was so you know, out of the way. I can imagine in 1932, there were even less houses around there then than there are now. And almost anybody could have walked up there in the middle of the night and walked in and done anything they wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very private. I mean, I'm sure that you could have fired off a gun up there all those years ago, and nobody, you know, locally would likely have heard it. There were houses there, but they were, you know, a distance away. Today it's a little bit more built up, but not much. And it's very, very strange to see the house. Of course, a lot of it is knowing what happened there, but it does kind of give off some bizarre vibes when you stand up there in the up in the trees and up in the hills and look off in the direction of that house and think of the people who lived there and what happened, and again thinking, gee, what, you know, what actually was the course of events on that night? That, you know, who was there, who did this, who did that, all this. So it was a lot of fun to try to imagine that and try to put it together in both a logical fashion and a colorful fashion and an exciting fashion and a credible fashion. That was another big thing, was to try to put this story together in such a way that even though, as we say in the beginning, it's a novel and it's not to be taken, you know, as gospel truth, certainly. Nevertheless, that when you read it, you can say, okay, that actually makes sense. Like I can, you know, go along with this particular trajectory of the story.
How much of the book is 100% real, and how much of it is 100% literary license?
I would say that probably it's about maybe 70 to 75% factual. Of course, that's not counting the fact that Porter Down is in it so much and that he's not real, you know, because
of course,
that would throw that off. But as far as the characters, where they are at a particular time, what they're doing, for example, at the time that Harlow was, that this happened on Harlow, she was making the film Red Dust with Clark Gable. You know, that actually was occurring. The Olympics were taking place in Los Angeles at that time in 1932. That was actually happening. The addresses are all valid. The descriptions of the places are all valid. The characters are very, very much based on everything I could read about them to try to give a fair assessment of what they were like. And you know, the credibility of them, and not to try to slant too much. As far as the fiction, we do have kind of a Lulu of a suspect in there with the character of the female pornographer, who I put into the book because of the fact that it was interesting that at that time in Hollywood, of course, it was pre-code, but it's very, very strange that at a particular time in Hollywood, 1932, there was, because a lot of crazy things were happening in the movies, but there also was a certain, actually a strain of almost bestiality in some of the films. And if you look at Tarzan the Ape Man, you know, there's a scene in which a gorilla tries to rape Jane. And if you look at DeMille's The Sign of the Cross, there's a Christian martyr bound to a pillar. The gorilla comes in, apparently he's going to have his way with the Christian martyr. There was the movie Island of Lost Souls, in which, you know, Charles Laughton as a mad doctor transforms a panther into a woman. Even a little later, King Kong, you know, you kind of got the impression that you know, King Kong and Fay Wray, but the character, you know, with the Fay Wray character was somewhat enamored of her, that sort of thing. And so I put this character in there to sort of represent that this was happening, that this was, you know, that how far Hollywood was going in those days, and that this female pornographer kind of had her hand in each of these films, you know, as far as developing ideas and sending off concepts to the producers to try to incorporate all this into the movies they were making. So as far as that goes, but as far as that character Porter Down, they're totally fictional. I do put in the back a pretty long explanation of who was fictional, who's real, what's based on actual events, that sort of thing. So I think that a reader would get a very accurate idea of what led up to all of this, the wedding, the time in between the wedding and the death of Paul Byrne, the what was happening at MGM, what was happening in Hollywood, all of these things, they would get a good, accurate representation. Where it would change is actually in how Byrne dies. And it would change in the fact that there is this very pugnacious private investigator in there, you know, getting
course,
in trouble
yeah.
constantly, kind of narrating the thing along. So, it's a good question. You'll learn a lot about the actual case by reading the book, but you can't accept it as, you know, an avowed reading of the event.
There is a name, and every time I look into any scandal in Hollywood, this name keeps popping up. And it's from the even from the 30s and 20s up to the 50s. His name is Eddie Mannix.
Oh, yes. Eddie Mannix. Eddie Mannix is a big, is very prominent in this story. And Eddie Mannix was the general manager at MGM. And Eddie Mannix was had formerly been, it's interesting because, you know, MGM was considered, you know, the Tiffany of Hollywood studios. I mean, you know, you had Garbo there and you had, you know, total class was the way that they advertised themselves.
More and stars than there are in heaven.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly. And Eddie Mannix was their general manager, and Eddie Mannix was a thug. All right. And Eddie Mannix had been, you know, a bouncer at the Palisades Park in New Jersey, you know, when he started his career. And, you know, Mannix frequently solved a problem by punching the other person or worse. and he was very, he could have told an incredible story had he decided to ever, you know, relate what he, all that he knew and all that he had done. But, he was very involved in this case. And in this book, he plays a very vital part in what is happening. But, you know, it's interesting. You have to say something about Eddie Mannix and Mayer. And that is that these men believed in all seriousness and absolute entirety that what they were doing, whatever was good for MGM, was good for the world. It was good for all the employees that worked there. It was good for everybody. You know, you couldn't let, if some star got into trouble and decided to misbehave and, you know, they would decide to throw them out or something, you know, and somebody said, oh, you know, come on, give them a break. And, you know, Mayer would say, well, you know what will happen if we keep putting this particular person into movies? The public will stop going to our movies, and if the public stops going to our movies, then the people who work here, who clean the sets and paint the buildings and make the costumes and rig the lights, they're going to be out of a job. And if they're out of a job, wouldn't that be awful? Because all of us are involved in this big dream factory together, and we have to make it foolproof. We have to make it safe for all of us that we can all be here for 30 or 40 or 50 years and get a pension and move on. And so he really saw him as this, saw himself as sort of this benign God figure. He certainly wasn't, but but he preferred to see himself that way. And Mannix was sort of like, you know, his chief apostle, you know, that that Mannix would get in there with the fists and handle the dirty business when he had to. And and of course he you know, he it goes over the years, and of course, you know, right up to the death of George Reeves, who played Superman. Mannix played you know, was dramatized in the film about that, and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, he Eddie Mannix was quite a character, and he knew where the he surely knew where the bodies were buried.
How did you develop a taste for Hollywood mystery, so to speak?
Oh, gee, I became fascinated by movies. You know, it's funny. Back when I was about 6 years old, which goes a long way back, back to 1957. And actually what happened was that I was a little kid and Shock Theater came on television, you know, the old horror films. And I can remember watching some of these with my dad, and it came on 11:15 Saturday night. My wonderful parents, and they actually allowed me to stay up this late as long as one of them would stay up with me. And I remember one of the first things I would ask whenever we would watch those films is I would say to my father, what do you know about him? Or what do you know about her? Or was Boris Karloff a nice person? Was Bela Lugosi a nice person? You know, did Lon Chaney like having all that hair all over his face when he played the Wolfman? All these kind of questions would come up, you know, from a six-year-old kid. And I thought this is something I'll grow eventually, I figured, but it only got worse. It only advanced. And so with that came other films. And I got, of course, I got interested in Westerns. I got interested in every genre of movie, really, by the time I was out of college. And I used to do a lot of acting and in this area of the country. Baltimore particularly, and you know, became very interested in the theater and the behind the scenes accounts of what happened, and and all that sort of thing. So it always became sort of like an archaeological dig for me. You know, it was start off with, this is what you know about this movie. You just saw it on television or on video. Now see what you can find out about what happened when they made it. And of course, when I started, fortunately for me and for them, a lot of people were still alive who had worked on the films. And for example, the first book I did was about horror films, about the old Frankenstein films. And for example, Elsa Lanchester was still alive, so I was able to interview Elsa Lanchester about having been the Bride of Frankenstein. And
fantastic!
And yeah, that was quite an experience. and she was great. She was wonderful. And and a lot of the people over the years, and including, which always turned out to work out very well. Families, wives, husbands of people who were celebrities. Again, with the horror thing, I spoke to two of Bela Lugosi's former wives. All right, one to whom he was, you know, married, his fourth wife and his fifth wife, actually, as it turned out. And of course, they were both extremely candid ladies, and they told me things I would have never dared to have asked them. But they brought them up themselves. And so I ended up knowing a lot more about Bela Lugosi than I expected to know.
Wow. You know, that's another book.
I actually did a book on Karloff and Lugosi, sort of a dual biography. And so there was a lot of stuff in there from both those ladies about Lugosi, naturally, but that's always been the big fun of it. And it's interesting that after all these years of talking to so many of the people who were around back in those days, you know, sad but true, there aren't that many left anymore. And so I think that has been part of the inspiration, part of the fun of working on the novels, is take the amount of knowledge that information and stuff that I've found over the decades, and put that together, and then add the extra element of fiction and some make believe and that sort of thing to connect everything together, and then you know, shoot it out there. So it's been fun, a lot of fun.
And do you have another book in the works right now?
I do have another one. I have another one, the third Porter Down book, which is, this one is going to be in the horror realm, and it's about it's going to take place in the mid 1930s in Hollywood, and it's going to involve vampires. So I'm trying to explore right now to find out all kinds of arcane information about vampires that I never knew before, and it's keeping myself up at night doing that.
You'll be visiting Bela Lugosi again then.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He's very prominent in the book. And it's interesting because he was an extremely nice man, very, very gregarious, nice man, kind of, you know, give you the shirt off his back kind of personality, and just, you know, apparently wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man. Very sad end, but you know, a very, very dynamic actor and a real gentleman and a real friend to everybody that was fortunate to call him friend. So, as was Harlow, Jean Harlow was, she apparently, if you were friends with Harlow, again, she was, that was one of the things I think that maybe moved me the most about writing this book, was the fact that she really was such a lovely person. She was such a nice person. She was such a good person. She was an awful lot of heartbreak about her because, again, similar to what I mentioned a while ago, she, you know, she was much more concerned with making other people happy than she was with herself being happy. She wanted to make her mother happy. Her mother was a complete crazy stage mother. And, you know, she wanted to make her mother happy. In fact, she even took her mother's name, you know, Jean Harlow, the actress's name was actually Harlene Carpenter. And her mother actually had been named Jean Harlow. So she did make her mother happy. She became Jean Harlow in the movies, that sort of thing. And, you know, with Byrne, I think she married Paul Byrne, realizing that he had a lot of problems, but she thought, well, he's a nice man and this will make him happy if I marry him. And you know, that was really the way that she kind of went through life. It was you know, what can I do to make other people happy? Kind of situation, even if this doesn't really work for me. You know, right up to the end. I mean, when Harlow died, she was dying from kidney disease, and it almost right up to the end, she kept going to the studio and working on her last film. And, she didn't want to disappoint any of the production people. She didn't want to disappoint Clark Gable, was her leading man again in that one. She didn't want to disappoint anybody who was there, because they thought she would thrill to work with her. And, it's interesting, Jim, that one of the people I did, we talked about Wise. One of the people I spoke to, there was a character actor in the films named George Zucco. And he made a lot of horror films, but he made a lot of other films too. And he was in Saratoga, and he played Jean Harlow's doctor in a scene in Saratoga. And at that point, she was very, very ill. I mean, she had a very short time left to live. But I remember asking George Zucco's widow, I said, "Do you remember back way back when your husband was making Saratoga? What were his impressions of Jean Harlow?" And he said, he thought she was absolutely wonderful. He said, when she came on the stage, she just lit up the whole place. She was so nice. She greeted everybody. She talked to everybody. She was so nice to him. She never fluffed a line. She was just absolutely terrific. And of course, she was being all these things at a time when she only had a very, very short time to live and must have felt very, very ill. And she may not have known that she was dying, but she certainly knew that she was very sick. But she didn't, she didn't phone in sick. She didn't dog it in the scene. She didn't do any of these things. She showed up and she made sure that everybody who met her wasn't disappointed.
Amazing.
And, that was what she was like.
Well, the author's name is Gregory. Let me get that out straight. Gregory William Mank. And the book is Platinum Widow, Who Killed Gina Harlow's Husband? It's a Porter Down mystery, and it's published by Bear Manor Media. Greg, I want to thank you for being on Lights, Camera, Author tonight.
Jim, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.